Today is Thursday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, with a pause in the tension between Tehran and Washington, what's next?
The president and Iran are both pausing to evaluate what just happened, and I think both sides are signaling a desire to de-escalate, but yet warning that there could be future clashes.
Plus, with just about 3 weeks to go before Brexit, what challenges face British Prime Minister Boris Johnson? Those stories and more are next. In a highly anticipated speech Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump signaled the U.S. would not take military action in response to more than a dozen ballistic missiles that Iran fired at two Iraqi air bases housing U.S. troops, but instead would impose additional harsh economic sanctions against Iran to further damage its economy.
U.S. armed forces are stronger than ever before. Our missiles are big, powerful, accurate, lethal, and fast. Under construction are many hypersonic missiles. The fact that we have this great military and equipment, however, does not mean we have to use it. We do not want to use it. American strength, both military and economic, is the best deterrent.
Iran fired missiles into Iraq early Wednesday following threats by Iranian leaders of retaliation against the United States for an airstrike ordered by Trump that killed Iranian Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani. The U.S. leader said Soleimani was responsible for some of the absolutely worst atrocities. Trump also called for other signatories of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, to follow Washington's lead and abandon the nuclear deal with Iran. For more analysis on where things may go from here, I spoke to James Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation.
Well, I think the president and Iran are both pausing to evaluate what just happened, and I think both sides are signaling a desire to de-escalate, but yet warning that there could be future clashes if things go back to the way they were in Iraq before this most recent crisis.
If we take a look at what's going on in the region, you have Hezbollah calling for Iran to continue to make strikes. You have Iran saying that as long as sanctions are in place, there's really no need to have discussions. And yes, the pause button appears to have been pushed on either any kind of further escalations. Has the needle moved substantially to change the situation?
I think it has changed substantially in Iraq, both for the better and for the worse. I say for the better in the sense that Iran no longer can operate in Iraq under the assumption that it will not face repercussions. Since up until recently, it's been acting with impunity to hide behind its proxies to launch attacks. And the strike on General Soleimani, if nothing else, will lead to enhanced deterrence of Iran in Iraq. The bad news is that Iraqi militias tied to Iran still remain heavily armed, and one of them, led by Qais al-Hazali, has called on his followers to follow Iran's example to avenge the airstrike that killed Soleimani. So I think there's a chance that although Iran publicly is stepping back, Iran's puppets in Iraq are likely to step forward.
Well, what kind of impact could that have if those claiming loyalty or supporting Iran's government carry out action against, say, U.S. forces or U.S. allies in the region?
Well, the last time that happened in Iraq, the U.S. responded with five airstrikes, including two that were in Syria. And that signaled a willingness to escalate outside the Iraq theater to hurt Qatab Hezbollah, which launched the December 27th attack in Syria as well as Iraq. So if it happens again, there's a possibility that this could spread eastward instead of westward at targets linked to the Revolutionary Guards. But, you know, that's something that Iran cannot rule out at this point. And after the death of General Soleimani, I think President Trump has a lot more credibility in Tehran.
And what kind of implication would that have for the region? Because we're not talking just about Iran and Iraq, but, you know, Israel and other countries and the Gulf area as well could all be affected by this.
Yes, and they're already have been affected by Iran's long-term campaign to set up proxy militias. I mean, Israel and Iran essentially have been at war in Syria, and Israel has launched hundreds of airstrikes that have killed Iranian Revolutionary Guards and their Syrian proxies. So that's nothing new for Israel. Other countries long have resented Iran's efforts to subvert and radicalize members of their Shia populations and its efforts to work with Sunni extremist groups. So, you know, I think behind the scenes there are many in the region that are happy that the Revolutionary Guards have been brushed back.
That was Heritage Foundation Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs, James Phillips, speaking to me from his office in Washington. Congressional Democrats are voting today to curb U.S. President Donald Trump's ability to pursue open conflict with Iran. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi explained why.
Today, we will have a resolution on the floor put forth by Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin. We're very proud of her experience in terms of national security under Democratic and Republican presidents, now a member of Congress, putting forth a resolution of this week. Last week, in our view, the administration conducted a provocative, disproportionate airstrike against Iran, which endangered Americans, and did so without consulting Congress.
Tensions between the United States and Iran appear to be easing Wednesday after Trump said Iran's ballistic missiles attack on an Iraqi base proved the country was standing down. But congressional Democrats and the administration has yet to outline a clear strategy for dealing with the Islamic Republic following the U.S. airstrike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us from Capitol Hill. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So what can you tell us about this bill that Speaker Pelosi is putting forward?
Sure. So it's a non-binding resolution, which is actually causing a little bit of a debate up here on Capitol Hill this morning, a back and forth between Speaker Pelosi and the top Republican here on Capitol Hill, Kevin McCarthy. There's been a lot of back and forth, especially in the past day since the classified briefing for members of Congress, about whether or not Democrats' questions about the Soleimani airstrike were valid, whether it was coming at the right point in the debate, and whether they really should be holding the vote on this issue. Democrats are arguing that they have a right under the U.S. Constitution to question the president about going into war, going into conflict, and that this vote today really starts that debate. Meanwhile, Republicans are criticizing the Democrats because they're saying that they are supporting Soleimani by asking these types of questions. So really, it's getting a little bit ugly up here today.
Speaking of that classified briefing, some Republicans and some Democrats have also come out and said that there were a lot of questions that left to be remain as to whether or not there was an imminent threat, which the president has authority to take immediate action on.
Right. Yeah. So yesterday it was really interesting to see two Republican senators come out of that classified briefing. And we're used to seeing Republicans come out in support of President Donald Trump and his decision-making process. But that was not the case with these two senators, Paul and Lee, yesterday, who said that it was one of the worst briefings they've ever received during their time in the U.S. Senate, and that they really were not provided with the information they would need to function as another branch of government that's supposed to be a check on the executive branch, a check on the presidential decision-making process. They were very upset and said that they would vote in support of that War Powers resolution that's due to come up in the U.S. Senate about sometime next week.
We only have about 40 seconds left. I want to turn the tables and talk about impeachment. Speaker Pelosi also says that they're still trying to have some negotiations with the Senate, but both some Senate Democrats and Senate House members have said it's time to turn over those articles.
That's right. But we, of course, just heard Speaker Pelosi say that she will turn them over in due time when she is ready, that she is still waiting to see the arena for impeachment managers. We know, of course, that the Speaker of the House is in charge of appointing those kind of managers who run the case through over in the Senate. She says she is not going to name them until she knows how that Senate trial is going to run. And she is still holding back, even though she's getting a little bit of criticism within her own caucus.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. She's speaking to us from Capitol Hill. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're so welcome.
A top Ukrainian security official set out what he said were four main theories for why a Ukrainian airliner crashed in Iran the previous day, killing 176 people, including a possible missile strike and terrorism. Ozlisky Danilov, secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, made a statement as an initial report by Iranian investigators said that the plane, a Boeing 737-800, had been on fire immediately before it crashed. In a Facebook post, Danilov wrote, "Ukraine is looking at various possible causes of the crash. They also include a possible collision or an engine explosion." The crash happened hours after Iran launched missile attacks on U.S.-led forces in Iraq, leading some to speculate that the plane may have been hit. But an initial assessment by Western intelligence agencies that the plane had suffered a technical malfunction and that it had not been brought down by a missile. That's according to five security sources who spoke to Reuters news agency, three Americans, one European, and a Canadian, all of whom asked not to be named. Danilov said Ukrainian investigators in Iran wanted to search the crash site for possible debris of a Russian missile after seeing reports about its possible existence on the internet. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have predicted that two of the several dozen dwarf galaxies now orbiting the Milky Way will eventually collide and merge with our galaxy. Recent studies suggest the Large Magellanic Cloud could crash into our galaxy in about 2.5 billion years. New research presented at a recent meeting of the American Astronomical Society proposes that this approaching collision is already producing new stars in the far reaches of the Milky Way that is usually populated by the galaxy's oldest stars. An analysis of a cluster of these young stars suggests that they have an extragalactic origin and were probably formed with material from the Magellanic Clouds. The research also finds that a stream of gas spreading from the dwarf galaxies is about half the distance of colliding with the Milky Way than previously thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex have announced that they would be stepping back from British royal life. Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliams on Wednesday gave his reaction to Prince Harry and Meghan's announcement.
The way this has been handled and the fact that a statement was put out apparently without either the Queen or other senior members of the royal family knowing about it is simply almost beyond belief.
The BBC reports that Buckingham Palace is disappointed. Harry said that after months of reflection and discussion, the couple planned to carve out a progressive new role by stepping back and splitting their time between the United Kingdom and North America to allow their family the space it needs. While that news has been dominating the British news cycle, January is the month in which Prime Minister Boris Johnson seeks to take Britain out of the European Union. For more on that, as January 31st approaches, I spoke to Henry Ridgewell in London.
the legislation has to pass through different levels. Back in December, it passed the first stage of voting in the House of Commons. Today, it's back in the House of Commons for another reading and another vote. And then it goes next week to the House of Lords. That's, in effect, the upper chamber, like the Senate, where it will be scrutinised again in the House of Lords. But it would be a great surprise if any of them wanted to pass any amendments. And then it will come back to be signed by the Queen into law.
That's just over 3 weeks away. And Michel Barnier has come out and said that the 11 months after that, the end of 2020, which is Boris Johnson's deadline to try and get all the ramifications of the divorce deal in place, the trade deal with the EU, Barnier says that probably won't be able to take place.
Exactly. It's a very tight time frame, even if it was 11 months. But if you factor in that it's likely that every single national parliament within the European Union will have to ratify this, that gives us even less time, perhaps only 6 months, to negotiate this ambitious free trade agreement that Boris Johnson says will be possible and will be easy. There's two different schools of thought on this. There's Boris Johnson's reasoning that already Britain is exactly closely aligned with the European Union because it's still a member. So if you start from the point where we're already aligned, then it won't be much of a jump to go to a free trade agreement where we can carry on trading very freely and very easily. And so a trade deal won't be that hard. But then there's the European Union school of thought, which says, well, actually, we have hundreds of different issues to negotiate over, whether it's going to be access to British fishing waters for European fishing boats, financial services, the sharing of data, you name it. Every single aspect of the relationship between Britain and the European Union is now up for grabs. And so it's going to be a very, very tough year of negotiations. And those who say that Brexit is going to be done at the end of this month, well, guess what? On February the 1st, that's when the real hard negotiations begin, and we'll be talking again exactly about what the future relationship might be.
Could this, in fact, linger on past the end of the year and usher in new discussions and new delays that Boris Johnson doesn't want to see?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's going to be his first major difficulty, in that he has promised to get Brexit done. That was his slogan in the election. That was his slogan during his leadership campaign for the Conservative Party. And now reality is going to hit the Conservative Party, and it's going to hit Boris Johnson. And the fact is, I think most people accept, even senior members of his own party accept, that it would be impossible to work out every single detail of the future relationship with Europe, by far Britain's biggest trading partner, in a matter of a few months.
That was reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking to me from London. The World Meteorological Organization warns Australians should brace themselves for a protracted summer of catastrophic brush fires, blaming climate change for record-breaking heat waves and persistent drought. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Australia's summer fire season usually begins in late January or early February. This time it got off to an early and catastrophic start in September in the states of Queensland and New South Wales. The bushfires have killed more than 22 people, destroyed hundreds of homes, burned large swathes of land, and caused massive devastation to wildlife, ecosystems, and the environment. The World Meteorological Organization warns the current fire season is likely to be unusually long and challenging, with the potential for further catastrophic outcomes. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says naturally occurring climate variability is playing a role in these unprecedented events. She says another driver is a phenomenon called the Indian Ocean Dipole, which was very strong last year.
And that has the effect of making Australia drier. It has the effect of making East Africa wetter, which is why we saw the floods in East Africa. So on the one hand, you do have the natural climate variability. On the other hand, climate change is playing a role, and we should be in no doubt about that.
A report by the Australian Bureau of Meteorology says climate change is causing temperatures to rise and contributing to long-term increase in extreme fire weather. It says December 19th was the hottest day on record, with an average temperature of 49.9 degrees centigrade recorded at Nullarbor in South Australia. Nullis says Australia's bushfires have far-reaching consequences.
The fires have led to hazardous air quality, which is a threat to human health, in major cities in Australia, spreading to New Zealand, and sent smoke drifting thousands of kilometres across the Pacific to South America. And NOAA satellites sent out a tweet that the smoke is in the process of circumnavigating the planet.
WMO scientists warn wildfires harm the global climate by emitting carbon dioxide. They say forest loss leads to the reduced uptake of CO2 from the atmosphere, further fostering climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in southeastern Australia are urging residents to evacuate as the massive brush fires will get a boost thanks to the return of extreme heat and heavy winds later this week. Temperatures are expected to soar above 30 degrees centigrade on Friday, ending the rain and cooler temperatures that provided a brief respite for weary firefighters who have been battling the flames. A small but growing number of Hong Kong protesters who fled to Taiwan for safety over the past few months fear an opposition victory in the island's election this week will put them in peril and force them to leave. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has that story.
Taiwan has seemed like a safe haven for Hong Kong protesters fearing arrest. Marches in cities across Taiwan have called for Hong Kongers to strive on. And messages of support had appeared on the streets of Taipei. While protesters who fled here have no legal way of gaining permanent asylum, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has allowed dozens of them to temporarily stay. But an upcoming election could hand victory to the opposition, and some fear they could force them to leave. One protester, who goes only by Jero, says he planned to stay in Taiwan. He says he doesn't think he can go back to Hong Kong after he took part in the storming of the city's legislative council in July, something he fears he could face up to a decade behind bars for. Taiwan's history is complicated. China considers it its own and wants to bring it under its control. The current president is from a pro-independence party, but her challenger favors closer ties with China. And even though he's voiced support for the Hong Kong protesters, the prospect of a Han Kuo-yu presidency is still concerning some of the people who have fled here. One protester who didn't want to reveal his real name explained why.
When Han Kuo-yu visited Hong Kong, he ran to the Hong Kong liaison office to meet with cadres of Communist China. That showed clearly that he's of the pro-China faction and therefore our enemy. Communist China is Hong Kong's and Taiwan's common enemy, so this is why we have such an antipathy towards his pro-China stance.
Saturday's election will see who call the shots for the next 4 years. Until then, all the protesters can do is wait.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. Lebanese prosecutors issued a travel ban for fugitive ex-Nissan chief Carlos Ghosn and asked him to hand in his French passport Thursday, following an Interpol-issued notice against him. The travel ban comes after prosecutors interrogated Ghosn for nearly 2 hours over the notice about the financial misconduct charges he faces in Japan. Ghosn said he wanted to stay in Lebanon and has no issues with handing in his passport. Tokyo prosecutors who arrested Ghosn in late 2018 said he had only himself to blame for his earlier four-month-long detention and for the strict bail conditions that followed, such as being banned from seeing his wife. Nissan said it was still pursuing legal action against Ghosn despite his escape. China announced on Thursday that Vice President Liu He will travel to Washington next week to sign the Phase One deal with the United States aimed at de-escalating the trade war between the world's two biggest economies. The U.S. and Chinese officials have said that the agreement includes protections for intellectual property, food and farm goods, financial services, and foreign exchange, as well as a provision to dispute the resolution. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition and the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Bill Werkinger, and engineer Cornelius Tenner, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day, and you'll also be able to find archived copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.